Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Mary Ramsey is, in my estimation, among an elite class of musicians. When she plays the viola, the violin, she transports you to other worlds and other eras. Her beautiful playing is matched by her beautiful singing voice, and both of those things reflect a beautiful person. She's the lead singer for the 10,000 Maniacs. She plays with John and Mary in the Valkyries. She plays in a great band with me called The Girls Gone Mild, and it is my pleasure to be able to interview Mary Ramsey today. Mary Ramsey, my friend, how are you?
I'm doing very well.
Thank you for driving out to see me today.
Yes, well, it's a beautiful drive, and I didn't get pulled over by any police.
This time. That did happen, actually,
oh, yes,
one time.
Oh, yes, did.
For you just minding your own beeswax, but you had out-of-state plates, you had nothing on your car said Hamburg, so they were suspicious.
Yes, I think, I was driving back, we had been judges in that competition at the Hamburg
the palace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, and we were the big time judges, and I think I was leaving and I got lost, and I picked up my cell phone.
Uh-huh. And that's two strikes already. You're not allowed to get lost in Hamburg or pick up your cell phone, let alone try to use it.
I know. I think the outcome was good, though.
I think I remember it was too.
Yes.
You had to do some community service. I think you had to clean the flower beds around the roundabouts, right?
Perhaps, but I think you might have had a little influence there.
We can only hope.
Yes.
All right, so listen, here's a new tradition I've been doing with people on this show, and so far it's been popular. Let's see if you agree. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you about a couple other Mary Ramseys, okay?
Okay.
Not you, but there's two other Mary Ramseys that I found. One is at the University of Texas, Austin. She's a molecular biologist.
Oh.
And listen to this. She says, I am interested in the molecular mechanisms underlying behavioral and developmental processes. Do you agree? Like, are you similar to her in that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, wait. She's the swordtails. I don't know what that is. It might be a bird. The swordtails are a classic female mate choice system where females prefer large courting class males over smaller non-courting males.
Well,
do you agree with that?
Well, if they have nice personalities.
All right, so there's that Mary Ramsey.
Yeah.
And now we've got Dr. Mary Ramsey in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm. She's a neurologist.
Wow.
Right? And the only thing I want to say about her is she speaks multiple languages, including Spanish.
Ah.
Do you speak multiple languages, including Spanish?
Well, I do little phrases here and there, like dankjewel, that's Dutch.
For what? Thank you?
Yeah. Dankjewel. Obrigada, that's Portuguese.
Oh, that's good. What does that mean?
Merci. Obrigada. That means thank you.
Oh, so you just kind of go around the world saying thank you.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
And that's probably when you're on the stage and they clap, you say thank you. So you want to know the language, right?
Yeah. You know, yeah. When we are in the countries, which I try to speak a little of their language too.
Okay, that's good.
Accommodate. I was going to say my grandmother's name was Mary Ramsey.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my grandma, my dad's mother. Her name... She was born Mary Esther Stevens, and then she married my grandfather, Ralph Ramsey. And my grandpa always called her Steve. She was like a Betty Davis kind of gal.
Oh,
she,
that's cool.
She drove the car. My grandpa didn't. He drove, but she wanted to drive. She had her Pall Mall cigarettes and her little Fitz and water.
Dude, yeah, that's nice.
That was Mary Ramsey. And she was amazing, and she did embroidery.
Well, where are we talking? Western New York?
No, both my grandma and grandpa were born in Iowa, but they didn't know each other then. And then my grandfather went to D.C. and went to college. He became a lawyer. He went to George Washington University. My grandma would move there on her own. But they used to have these parties where people would meet each other from the states they're from, and that's where they met. And then,
well, like an Iowa night,
Iowa, yeah,
okay,
yeah. So, I mean, I have great pictures of my grandma when she was driving a T model Ford with overalls on, like at 13. You know, she was a pretty amazing woman.
Why did they come here to this area, Fredonia area, or what?
So they, you know, my dad and his brother were born in D.C., and they stayed in that area. And then, let's see, how did that happen? Well, I grew up in Greenbelt, Maryland until I was about 8, and then we moved to Fredonia. My family moved.
Because your dad is a professor, retired professor,
yes.
Right? Is that where he worked at Fredonia?
Yeah, he worked at Fredonia State.
Okay.
We moved in 1970 to Fredonia, and then my grandparents, when they retired and they lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, they wanted to go back to Iowa. So they went back to near Ottumwa, Iowa, and built a house, a little house near where my grandmother was born, and had some cows and stuff, beef cattle. And we used to go out and visit them in Iowa. But then they got lonely. They wanted to come back. And so they ended up moving and living with us in Fredonia for a year. And then they moved to Dunkirk, like right along the shoreline.
Yeah. That's nice there, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then over time they moved back to D.C. when that's where they
got. Wow, they're movers. That might be in your DNA a little bit, restless or this duality, right? This need or desire to travel and yet the need and desire to stay home.
Yes, that's very much part of how I feel. I love to be on the road. I mean, how do I say? I love it when I'm traveling and getting to all this, to see this beautiful world, I love the feeling the first time you come home. Then when you're home too long, you want to be on. I mean, I think a lot of people have that in their psyche, because I think a lot of people are traveling now for work. And
yes, I have a few topics I want to talk to you about today. One of them, actually, let's start with that. Can you just give me a little laundry list of some of the countries you've performed in?
Let's see. Well, I'll go from the last ones. Certainly Canada, Panama, Brazil, Argentina, Kuwait, Bahrain. I think that's how you say it. Bahrain.
Bahrain.
Somewhere way
over. And Baja, California. Have you been there?
I have. Wait, well, actually, I went to Baja. We were in Cabo San Lucas.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Mexico, but
yeah.
I didn't perform.
Okay. All right, keep going. So
I sang
Bahrain.
In the shower, but
okay.
Where else? Oh.
What about Europe?
Yes. So we've performed in London, England, and John and I and Lee Stoner. I don't know if you know Lee.
Mm-hmm.
He's a local English musician here. We performed in the Netherlands, Germany. Where else were we? Austria. Yeah, it's pretty great just to walk around these places and especially like way back when, because this was in like the probably early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem so Americanized. And,
yeah.
You know.
Do you find that throughout the world, is it true that music is a universal language?
I think so, yeah. Especially if it doesn't have any... If you don't have any words to it, like that's why playing instrumental stuff is speaking a language without words, you know. And,
yeah.
And then you, I think everybody is attracted to melody. So it's interesting. It's got a lot of different facets to it. Because when you have music with words, then that's very powerful too.
True, and a lot of people around the world are not. upset about the fact that they can speak more than one language, right? And so a lot of places speak English because why not? It's beautiful to speak more than one language. Yeah. Unlike this country where certain people, like, they take it personally if you ever suggest that we could speak more than one language.
It's strange. It's very strange because this is a country of so many languages and so many. I mean, we all came from all sorts of different places, and for whatever reason, English is the dominant. And I wish that I had learned other languages at a young age. I wish I know that they talk about it's when you're a young child is the best. Like if you have
it comes like this. I have nephews. I have three nephews that their mother and father have, from the beginning, English, of course, Spanish, and sign language.
Oh, wow.
So I think sometimes they're talking about me when I go to visit. I can get them on the Spanish because I kind of speak that, but the sign language just throws me.
Yeah.
And my other niece and nephew, their mother is bilingual, so they're learning Spanish as well. I think it's a great thing, you know?
It is. I know. My sister's kids... Well, her daughter especially was in daycare as a baby. She was in a bilingual daycare center, so she learned Spanish, and she's quite fluent now.
That's awesome. Well, it's never too late, Mary. Why don't we start taking... I want to learn French now. Do you want to take French classes with me?
Oui.
Oh, perfect. Let's do it. I need a partner in crime, too. We could practice. We could call each other and practice what we learned that day. Are you in?
Sure.
This is official now, your voice?
Oui, oui.
Okay, perfect. That's a done deal.
There's a song that John Lombardo and I recorded called Un Canadien Errant. I think it was on our first CD, Victory Gardens. And I hadn't taken French. My older sister had in school. And so what she did is she'd say it. I'd be on the phone with her, the verses, because there are a lot of verses.
Hmm.
Actually, you know Bob Stalter? Do you know
Yes.
him? He had like the whole list of the verses, but we didn't do every verse up to the song. Anyway, my sister Susan would say it, and then I would phonetically write it out.
Oh, so
that,
yes.
And then, but I'd also listen. I do think that being a musician, you do hear. I mean, there is a sense of being able to hear languages because there's a lot of...
You focus on the accents and the roundness of the verbs and the consonants, right?
And pitch changes and
ABBA. You gave it the old ABBA routine, right? Because they didn't speak English for a long time.
They didn't. And I like the way it's, I mean, it sounds great. Yeah.
So what's the name of that song that you recorded in French? I'm gonna translate for you as you say it.
I can't even say it right now.
A candy.
Un Canadien errant.
A Canadian in Iran.
No, a candy. It's the general meaning is this wandering Canadian. The story is about like the Acadian people that were kind of kicked out of they were kicked out of Canada, and ended up moving down to the. South,
like the Bayou, that's the Acadians. They were in Canada.
Well, yeah. I mean, the song is pretty much about wanting to go back to the homeland.
Yeah,
being sad.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing! Like the spelling Acadia, it's got a lot of the same letters as Canada. Do you think they just is that why they get kicked out because they were pronouncing it wrong? Like they were dyslexic? Maybe
something was going on.
Oh my gosh! Speaking of wordplay, yes, Mary Ramsey is a what?
Yeah.
Palindrome. Is it okay if I share that with the general public?
Absolutely.
Because yes, Mary Ramsey, frontwards and backwards, says yes, Mary Ramsey.
Yeah, I know. I didn't figure it out. Somebody told me this. I don't know who it was many years ago. And I said, well, I love that.
That's
so cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So when I'm spelling it to people, when they, you know, you buy something or on the telephone.
Yeah.
And I'll just do it, and they will say, they don't really see it as being backwards and forwards, and then I'll say it, and they go, wow.
That's pretty sweet. I think you should be proud of that.
And it's palindrome? Is it an M or an N? I always forget.
I should know.
Yeah, I should too.
I'm going to go with the M, palindrome, because a palindrome would be like if there's a little helicopter flying over you, right?
Yeah.
Sarah Palin, if she had a drone, palindrome.
Ah.
All right.
So it was not that one.
So traveling the world, okay. But I guess somehow this doesn't really dovetail with this, but I'm going to approach a different topic, and then maybe this will lead back to the Europe and traveling stuff, because you did say you went there in the early 90s a lot, right?
Not a lot, but a few times.
A few times, which is a few more than I've ever done it. So that's a lot to me.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty fantastic.
In the 1990s, okay, I have all these theories. Like, for example, when I was doing research on you, like I already know you, but I found out I was watching some cool stuff. You have done so much, Mary. Like, I was watching, first of all, in the 90s, the MTV Unplugged thing with 10,000 Maniacs, when Natalie Merchant was the singer then, and you were playing the viola.
Yeah.
And you came up and sat with her and did backing vocals on a couple songs, and you had some great leads on the viola throughout. Well, what I noticed about that, and I remembered about that, was the 90s. Mm-hmm. MTV, Unplugged. That was a big deal.
It was huge.
And so wasn't that an amazing experience for you? Like, was there an excitement that was palpable? Like, what was that?
Oh, yeah. The whole band was excited. The audience was excited. You know, it was because
you can tell it was very select, exclusive ticket probably to get in there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, I'm not sure how people got in there, but, yes. And, you know, you had cameras all around. So there's a sense of being, you know, anybody could be filmed. And that was what was interesting, is that it wasn't only the people on stage, but the people in the audience were probably on their best behavior.
And by the way, that was amazing for the people in the audience. That was part of the excitement, because now, 2018, it's a non-issue. But then it was like that was part of why it was a big deal. This, a new version of a live participatory event, right?
Right. And I think the thing about it that was unique is that there were other MTV Unplugged episodes that had happened before, but by the time that one happened, it had sort of developed its style and its fame and its how do you say it? People were aware of how often it would be played. Like, you know, I can go look at something on YouTube, like an old Austin City Limits of somebody, and say, that's really cool, but that wasn't played over and over again. I mean, it was archived.
Right.
These videos became, they were on rotation constantly, so that, you know, that, and because the night that was played a lot.
That is true.
And if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, you are right. That's true. And it was this wave that you were riding that was like, it was just the changeover. The beginning of like the real world was that reality show that a lot of people, I think, say was the first reality show. So you guys were right on the cusp of that. And it must have been a really, like, for me, it was an exciting time too. Like, I think I was having my own little splash of I would say fame, even though it was kind of pockets, but I felt it, you know? Yeah. And it's an interesting thing to experience, right?
It is. You know, I feel that probably when I first started to feel that I was getting, John and I especially were getting noticed, was when we made our first CD for Ryko Disc. And, well, I could even rewind it back when, I guess it was just when we started to perform together, and we were performing at Nietzsche's, where you've performed, like in Buffalo, performing these different places, and feeling, this is actually going to, I mean, this is kind of working, that people understand what we're doing and they like it and they're coming to shows. And and then, you know, then making a CD itself at that time was just so important.
It was, yes.
Remember?
Yes, making a CD at that time was so important. The actual technology of a CD was cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody was making a CD. Not everybody could make a CD.
Right. No one had home equipment to do that. You'd
right.
go places. And it was an important product, because that was, well, obviously people were buying it, and you get it out there. You know, it was
good point.
I actually had to, some of the John and Mary stuff, I couldn't find it anywhere, so I didn't really have too many. So I bought it bought them on Amazon.
That's good.
You know, I have a few that because I wanted to have some because they were being distributed through Breaker Disc, and I don't know if they sold or whatever. I certainly don't see the.
That's kind of cool to buy your own CD because you don't have any. I mean, that's I would say in the good problem.
Yeah,
category, because as opposed to, would you like a free CD? No, thanks. Right?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is you were doing it. You had so much control over everything you were doing, every aspect. So you had you could keep the CDs.
Yes.
Where we were, you know, this was with a label that kind of, you know, at some point you kind of lose track of where did they go? What happened?
I get that. Yeah. So do you remember also from that era, this idea of selling out? Do you remember that? Like what people would say, like we would have these big debates about, Should I put my song in a commercial? They want us to be in there, but oh no, you're selling out. Right?
Yeah,
remember that phrase was like this catchphrase all over musicians and the music. He's sold out.
Yeah.
They're selling out. Like, and now it's a given.
Yeah, because it's a way. It's certainly a way to make money where you can't. And it's a strange kind of situation to observe. Like, do you want to try to keep your art? And then, you know, in all different art forms, it's a sense of like, well, my integrity and my art is so sacred and precious. Mm-hmm. I can't taint it by putting it into something that won't be the way that I've envisioned the life of my art. And then there's the reality of just feeding yourself.
Yeah.
Clothing and having a roof over your head
and that's
that stuff.
That's a feat if you can do that, right?
Yeah.
If you can put a roof over your head by your art, that's a feat in itself, right?
Yeah.
And haven't we seen this also, this other sweep of the idea of fame, being famous? I remember when I was much younger, like, I wanted to be famous. When I played in my band in LA, that was my goal for us. Like, I want to be famous. And of course, for the music, but now, I personally, I don't think about that. Like, that's not even on my radar, partially because of the passage of time. But also, do you think young people still feel like that?
I think so, a bit.
You do?
Yeah, I think so, because it's a drive, and it's exciting, I feel like that the culture, the way we have now these cell phones that take pictures. There's ways of drawing attention to ourselves, of observing ourselves. You know, I mean, there's like Narcissus, you know, looking into the water. We want to, you know, we're observing. We want to observe ourselves. We want to show on Facebook, share these things and get the thumbs up or whatever, you know. And it's very healthy in some ways, but it's very unhealthy in other ways, I think. And I believe that there is like a fantasy to fame that sort of doesn't ever really change. It's kind of always been that way. We're thinking it's going to be something.
Yeah,
and then it turns into something else, you know. It's not,
okay. Yes. So back like the movie star era, the 40s, right? They were untouchable. You wouldn't even dream of seeing one, let alone talking to one. They were like demigods, right?
Yeah.
And then the whole rock music thing. Now, another thing I observed about like the 90s, the affect of in our genre of music, which is rock music, right? The affect of people was supposed to be understated. It wasn't like, look at me, I'm a movie star, I've got all this bling. It was sort of like, picture the Kurt Cobain with the sweater, you know what I mean? And the jeans and his head down. It's like, the affect of people that were famous was supposed to be, I don't really want this, but you're bringing it to me, right?
Right. And I do think there's some of that is, I mean, it's authentic that sometimes people, really artistic people, they're doing something that they feel they want to create, and they're expressing themselves. And but then it's like a process. They can't really see it. We can't see into the future. Like, how is that going to affect And then you get to that point, you go, oh, I don't know if I like this. I would imagine, you know, being, not having your own privacy and your, mm-hmm. that seems to be what is the,
yeah,
the part that's difficult.
Yeah.
That it's a mixed bag. It seems like you look at actors or you look at anybody.
What do you think about it for yourself?
Well, I never really think of myself as, you know, being famous or
you're
not.
I would say you're famous, but maybe we could agree on the fact that you're well known, right? People know you when you go somewhere, right?
But there's also the sense that I think people know there's a lot of well-known musicians and artists in Buffalo, but I think there's also the sense that we're almost like a working tribe of people, and that's a little different than the fame where somebody has uh-huh. this huge amount of wealth uh-huh. from what they've done. The wealth sort of, I think, transcends it into a different realm. You just kind of know, you know, we do these gigs and you're getting how much money you're getting. And,
right.
And
it's
you're like, okay, well.
I know there's some countries that sort of underwrite the arts.
Yes.
And make it easier to make a living as an artist.
I guess what I always thought was when I've read about people getting funding for this and this in these different kinds of countries, I thought, well, you know, do you have to have some sort of like deprivation of suffering or whatever to create something that's going to be, that's a romantic idea.
Yes.
That if you get everything, you know, if you're very comfortable with would that make you creating something better or worse or whatever?
Yeah.
You know, there's that. I'm always really thrilled to hear that people are making some kind of a living doing it, because I mean, that's like, you look at the Buffalo Philharmonic. Okay. That's the organization. They're very talented musicians in that. And then they have a whole group of other people that are working to keep it going, you know, keep the funds coming and all that. And then, you know, you look at dance organizations and
theater. In other words, yes, yeah, somebody, so the artists, the musicians aren't probably capable of keeping that Philharmonic going on themselves, because they want to play music. They want to practice. And they're not on the phone getting people to buy tickets and subscribe and things like that, right? So it needs both, right?
Right. And then, you know, that's what's more difficult about playing pop music or folk rock or whatever. You're going out there. You don't have that support system. Like, we don't in our country have, like, you can maybe get grants here and there. But you go around, you play, and you try to collect what you can. You can mm-hmm. try to keep going to different places. But there's that's something that, you know, it is sort of a lifestyle. You sort of say, okay, it's going to be what it's going to be. I wish it was a bit better sometimes, uh-huh. but it's also the experience of going out, playing, performing, getting some feedback from people in the audience, hopefully who aren't too out of their heads inebriated, but getting like a positive feedback from that and saying, okay, that's feeding me. That's feeding me to keep doing this too.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's a cool point.
Yeah.
You talked about the Philharmonic. You talked about like genres, like classical genre. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you this. You're classically trained, right? Is that how you got your start?
Years ago.
And do you remember, did you ever have to make a decision between, I almost want to say, like, I'm comparing it to like gospel music, religious and secular. Do you know what I mean? Like, the classical is like sort of up here on this.
I think of it as like an athletic feat to be a classical musician. There's a certain athleticism you have to have with your instrument. You have to understand it. Of course, to be very, very good and people want to listen, you have to know how to express yourself and add that element that makes it beautiful,
okay,
you know, or compelling.
Do you perceive classical music as a listener, first of all? Classical musicians versus pop or rock or whatever, hip-hop, jazz musicians, like, are they different sports?
Well, there's something that connects them all together. If that meaning, it's being authentic to themselves and authentic to the style of music. So there's some, I have to say, look, for classical music, there's some stuff you just really have to, you have to train your body to do, your body meaning your fingers and your, if you're singing classically or whatever, there's that element to it. And that's the same with jazz. And there, to some, there, it's the same with any kind of music, but it's, some of it's on a different level or different levels. But this, but if something's authentic and really connecting, it's, there's a similarity to, that's a similarity.
There's a thread.
All of
okay.
them, all of it.
Okay.
Know? That's how I, at least how I perceive it.
I got you. Yeah.
I've known people from all different kinds of musical backgrounds and styles, and you just, there's something that I know in my heart of hearts, like that, well, that's happening, you know, that's,
yeah,
that's real. And
yeah,
and I know for me, I love classical music or whatever, but I didn't find that that was my way to totally express myself, like that, that I, when I started to sing and play this kind of form music with John, started to write, so it was those, these other elements that I
yeah.
thought, oh, this feels a little bit more like where I want to be.
Okay.
But then I still can, I've played classical music and find it to be very exciting too. It's just, it's like dancing with different partners, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't do that very well, but maybe punk dance by myself.
All right. I have one more question to talk to you about and then we could take a little break. Okay.
Okay.
So this
Wonderful.
One is, oh, yes, here it is. Singing and or playing, right?
Yeah.
When I hear you, I feel like it's two different parts of you that are being expressed when you're singing and when you're playing. And I want to ask you, do you think that's true in any way? Or, and how can you compare those two functions?
Yeah. Well, playing, I'll start with that because again, it's, there is the, you've got the instrument, you know, I've got my viola, my violin or my Zeta, which is a 5-string electric thing I play. It's a violin, viola together. It's tactile, you know, it's, I'm holding this thing. And then I almost feel like it has a spirit. Like we work together to get this out, whatever mm-hmm. it is. And it's the vessel that I express through with, you know, with my musical ideas and feelings. And so it's funny. It's strange because I think about the physical part of it. You're almost like, it's like the way you hold an instrument like that, you're almost like kind of hugging it. I mean,
yeah.
It's strange. It's coming around. And then it's also like dance too. Like
the frame. The frame of dancing, yes?
Dancing, yeah. And then the bow arm is very, you know, there's almost like a dancer ballet quality to the bow arm with a violin viola, at least the way. So I find sometimes that I can get more lost in I can go into this other part of my musical expression because it's
yeah
has no boundaries in a way, and then with singing, I feel a connection with the tone and pitch and
oh God
and then
I was just thinking of you singing with playing with me singing because I don't unfortunately have the same connection with pitch and tone.
Yeah, you do though. You do.
All right,
you
so
do.
Keep going. I just got
yeah.
a little. I just got a little. Oh, okay. So,
but with you don't. You know, when you're singing, you're, you know, the whole thing about breathing. You know, it's a very grounding thing with singing because it's you're physically pushing all this air through. You know,
yes,
through yourself, and then it's you. It's expression and
Is there one of those two things that you're more either confident with or self-conscious about, or are you equally confident?
I know that I can say that my things I've done on the viola, I can say, yeah, I'm pretty happy with that. I'm
yeah.
happy, isn't it? It's like, that's it. And then with singing, singing's harder because it's like you're looking at yourself in the mirror in a way with singing, and there's this, it's sometimes harder to believe that's you.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, it's like, oh, okay.
I get that.
And then you'll hear somebody else sing and go, oh, I want to be like, I want to sing, I want to sound like them, but we can't, we sound like us. We, yeah. You know, if you try to sound like somebody else, I mean, if you really, really try, it's fun. You know, it's fun to like almost not mimic, but yeah. It's
not authentic. There's that word again. Right. You strive to be authentic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I try, but I die.
The authentic Mary Ramsey, let's take a little break. And then when we get back, we're going to talk about a person that you actually suggested that we look into their contributions to this world of music. All right?
Cooly cool.
Hi, Mary.
Well, hi there.
We're back. We had a nice little break, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
And now's the part of the show where we talk about a person who might be part of the great unsung. Maybe somebody that the general population doesn't know about. Now, obviously, with this person, a lot of people know about her. Yeah. She's world famous.
She is.
But I think it's worth talking about her for people like me who might not know about, ready? Kim Kashkashian.
Yes. That's her name.
So the
it's
yes.
a great name.
And obviously, she's not Kim Kardashian.
No, but she has been, she said that, you know, there have been times when she's been, in an interview I read that she's, people said, are you Kim Kardashian? And she said, no, I'm Kim Kashkashian.
Kim Kashkashian, which, yes.
She's of Armenian descent.
Yes.
As is the
Kardashians, yes. Which, by the way, the last name, any last name that ends with I-A-N mm-hmm. is Armenian. And that's yeah. the only nationality that you could be with the last name I-A-N, from what I read.
Yes, yes.
Isn't that cool?
And there's a, yeah, it's really cool. There, I know in California there are a lot of Armenians in Los Angeles, but yep. also Detroit and in these different areas. And it's such an... I mean, the history of Armenia is really
yes,
pretty fascinating.
Which we're going to talk about right now, okay? Because here's what I have to start mm-hmm. this off. Kim Kashkashian, mm-hmm. did I say that right?
Very good.
Is internationally recognized as a unique voice on the viola. She was born of Armenian parents in Michigan. She's from Detroit. So she studied viola with Karen Tuttle.
Yes.
And with Walter Trampler at the Peabody Conservatory of Music in Baltimore.
Yes, and I have to just interject because yes. when I was going to graduate from college, I hadn't finished two courses. I had two incompletes in independent studies in my undergraduate, but I had already started to apply to music schools for graduate. And I actually went to Peabody and took a lesson with Karen Tuttle.
Oh, you did?
Yeah,
she's apparently famous, right?
She's a very wonderful viola teacher, and I took a few lessons. And anyway, she was teaching at Peabody, and then she was teaching somewhere else. I think probably Manhattan School of Music. But I had gotten into five graduate schools, but I decided I just didn't want to play anymore for like a couple of years.
Okay,
but I know. So Kim was an assistant, I guess.
She received a 2012 Grammy Award for yeah. Best Classical Instrumental Solo in Courtauld and Ligeti, Music for the Viola. Does that mean mm-hmm. anything to you?
Well, they're contemporary composers that wrote some pieces
okay.
Which specifically for her.
Okay. Oh, that's cool. Okay. Yeah. So she, in 2001, she won a Cannes Classical Award. Mm-hmm. Cannes, France, right? Is that in France?
Probably.
For a premiere recording by soloist with orchestra. In 2016, Kashkashian was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. That's cool.
Yeah.
Her counterpart, Kim Kardashian, has not quite gotten that accolade yet.
Not yet.
She's not a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, but you never know.
She probably would wear the right outfit if she...
Correct. She, okay, so our Kim Kardashian, partnerships with pianist Robert Levin and percussionist Robin Shulkowski, string quartet with Gidon Kramer, Daniel Phillips, and Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah.
Okay. Soloist. As a soloist, she's appeared with great orchestras of Berlin, London, Vienna, Milan, New York, and Cleveland, and so on. Okay, so that's sort of like a little bit of the backstory of her accolades. Now, here's what I did a little research, and of course, as we said, her family's Armenian, and her grandparents came to the U.S. They survived the genocide. The Armenian genocide was Ottoman government's systematic extermination of 1.5 million Armenians, mostly citizens within the Ottoman Empire. The starting date is conventionally held to be April 24th, 1915, the day that Ottoman authorities rounded up, arrested, and deported from Constantinople, now Istanbul, 235 to 270 Armenian intellectuals and community leaders. They rounded them up. They killed them. That started it. And then it went throughout World War One, and the Armenian genocide essentially went date-wise from 1914 to 1923. So her grandparents were part of the people who were able to escape. And there's a cool story about how her grandfather, I don't know if it, I think it's her great-grandfather or grandfather. Sorry, I don't know.
Yeah.
But knew a Greek person who... The family hid in a barn and were fed and housed for months before they were able to come to Ellis Island. And that's only one of the many stories of her background that are fascinating stories of the immigrant experience in the United States, right?
Yeah. You know, I was reading a little bit about her, too. I first came across her because, well, I'm a violist, but is more of her... performances of contemporary composers and unusual musical pieces, and the fact that she just plays the viola so beautifully. She's technically amazing, and it's just, it's like flawless. But and for me, I would think, wow, that she's got this huge viola. I think it's an Amati, which is one of the, you've got Stradivarius, Amati, Guarneri, Del Gesù, like these wonderful Italian.
I was thinking those are kinds of cheese, but you know, violas.
They're violins, violas, you know, the string family. And that, another thing wonderful about, you know, Italian, the gifts that the culture is given, besides wonderful food and wine and, you know, paintings.
And hot babes.
Yeah, beautiful.
Is the are the instruments and the craftsmen, right?
Yeah.
Which, by the way, let me read this quote. Her interest in 20th century music developed naturally. She says, quote, I feel that part of my job as a musician is to tell the news, to spread the word about what's going on in the musical world. After all, until maybe 100 years ago, performers played mostly music that was being written at the time. It's our obligation, as well as a challenge and a pleasure, to work with the composers of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So in the classical world, is that a little bit of a... something different to play contemporaries? Like,
well, there's yes and no, yes and no. I mean, there for her, I think that which is an interesting point is that these composers heard her the way she played and said, I want to compose a piece, and just for her. Like, if somebody met you and said, I want to write a piece for you to perform,
because
you're inspiring me the way you sing or play.
Yeah,
and that's
exciting, yes.
Right. And she really has, she has a great way of understanding it. Like, when I go to YouTubes and have listened to these different composers that she's worked with, or her performances, it's very soulful, it's very beautiful, and it's the viola.
Okay, now listen to what she says about her viola. She says, sad, an instrument can't be sad. An instrument can become anything, depending on the hands and the imagination of the person who's using it.
Yes.
Yes?
And that's a great quote.
We no longer even agree there's such a thing as a particular viola sound. The viola is still in a state of flux, of experimentation. Every few years, somebody comes out with a new, differently shaped viola, just like what you said.
Well, that's even going beyond, like, there are different dimensions, but when she's talked about a different shape, there's one that this woman I knew in California, she had a viola that was built by, I don't know who it was, but anyway.
Just say some Italian name. Petruchio.
Spaghetti.
Yes.
Pizza. But it looks sort of like a Salvador Dali kind of strange shaped kind of, so that the body is kind of like at a weird angle, and then the length of the fingerboard is the same length as like a violin. So,
okay. She studied the violin. I don't know if you did first, but
yes.
Here's what
mm-hmm.
she says. She says she began to play the violin when she was 8. I know you started when you were 5.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And she said, I really wanted to play the clarinet, but a cousin's violin was sitting in the closet, and my mother felt I should play an instrument that was already in the family. So she started with the violin lessons. Okay. She studied, and when she was 12, it says she went somewhere, Interlaken Arts Academy.
Yes. Yeah, that's a music school for, a very nice music school, good music school, art school for high school kids.
Okay, and she says, where I was able to borrow a viola and simply move back to the register I'd wanted in the first place. Is that the clarinet is in the register? Oh, because the lower...
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the tone, probably, too.
So she says, she studied viola at the Peabody Conservatory, Philadelphia Musical Academy with Karen Tuttle.
Mm-hmm.
Then she moved to Germany for, I believe, 12 years, where she taught at, are you ready for this? Oh, gosh.
You want me to look at it for a second?
Sure. It's right here. Hans, right here.
Oh, okay. Hans Eisler Hochschule für Musik in Deutschland.
Oh, that sounds better. That sounds better. So that sounds like a place you would want to be, right?
Yeah.
Has a daughter. So for, I think, I'm getting my, like around 10 years, she lived there and she taught there. And when she was in Europe, she says that... This is like a quote from back then. She said, I began to realize that a violist has far more opportunities for solo playing in Europe than in America. That's always been true, and it still is true. Here, America, the viola is just beginning to be reluctantly respected as a solo instrument, while in Europe, it is fully accepted. Describing the differences between European and American musical life, she says, there's more flexibility in Europe. There are more small organizations that can survive. Every town has its own orchestra and chamber music series. There are more broadcasts of classical music, both live and recorded. First of all, what is chamber music?
Chamber music is more small ensembles like duets, quartets, trios,
okay,
quintets, that sort of thing where it's not like an orchestra. I mean, you can have a chamber orchestra, which usually is just a string orchestra or a smaller orchestra.
Yeah.
But there's smaller groups that composers wrote music for, you know.
Okay. Another thing about Kim Kashkashian mm-hmm. is, now, her counterpart, Kim Kardashian, is known for her mm-hmm. beautiful derriere. Do you know that? Her voluptuous figure. Well... Our Kim Kashkashian is known for something, and that is her way of playing. It's unorthodox. Do you know this about her? Indeed, Kashkashian's way of playing is so unorthodox that if one has not heard or seen her perform, one might think it's an impossible dream.
Mm-hmm.
She says, perhaps we should... all little kids want to let the wrist collapse. What
yes.
does that mean?
So it's like the way when you see fiddlers play, when you take your left wrist where you're holding the violin or viola or whatever, you're going to put the palm of your hand onto the neck. So, okay. Because it makes sense instead
to let it rest on there.
Right, because it's like you're holding up. Logically, you think, well, it's easier to hold it because I'll hold it in the palm of my hand and then bring the fingers around instead of just kind of holding it on your thumb okay. or in the crooks of your thumb.
So that's kind of like a no-no, right? The collapsed wrist, like by...
Yeah, in more classical stuff, yeah.
Okay, so she says, perhaps we should listen to them about kids who want their wrist to collapse, right? Yeah. She says, you know how to find the most natural position. Oh, they know. The kids know how to find the most natural position. Mm-hmm. Also, have you noticed how babies grab your finger? Their grip is so strong that they can really tug on you, though there's no muscle, no tension. It's an absolutely perfect bow grip.
Yes, it is. And when I teach, I think of it as like you put your hand in a fist. It's like a rose hasn't bloomed yet. So you open it up. I kind of use that description. And then, but yes, you know, when you're relaxed, when you're asleep, you don't have your fingers straight out. You have your hands curved. So this, like this, having your hand open up, you have it in a fist, and then you open it up slightly. The bow fits right in there, you know. And
okay.
It's taking what we have naturally in our bodies, the way our bodies are naturally when they're relaxed, and trying to incorporate holding a stick in one hand and then holding a huge instrument. And I saw her perform at UB about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And she was doing a classical concert. I think it was all Schumann or Schubert music. And I was just astounded that she doesn't seem like she's very tall. I mean, she's not a big person. And she had this big viola and seemed effortless. Like she wasn't tired and it didn't look like it hurt her. And it didn't look like, you know, and it was beautiful. It was gorgeous. That's what I find about the viola is that I don't mean to say like it's not supernatural, but there's a sense of it. Like when you read stories of, you know, mythology or like, you know, Celtic mythology or, you know, stories about the woods and about nature and poetry, you know, about that sort of subject matter, that you really feel like this instrument is conjuring up a mood and a scenario that
it recreates it.
Yeah, I mean, even if you listen to, like, when I listen to sometimes like an oboe or an English horn.
Yeah.
I'll think, oh, that does really remind me of this animal.
It's it's like, well, here's this quote that she said in an interview. Like, just it's sort of not super related to music, but it is. So listen to this. She says, our understanding of the present is based on our memories. And I would make an additional proposition that those memories are not confined to our lifetime. And I'm not speaking of reading about the past, but I'm speaking of experiencing it on a cellular level in our own bodies. So, like, I think music can sort of be the conduit through which people can feel past, not past lives, but like the same feelings people felt in the past.
Yes.
Right?
Right. Because you're listening to, and even performing it too. You're kind of time traveling because if you're singing a song that somebody sang, even somebody sang 10 years ago, you're kind of stepping into the shoes of that. And then that artist. And then when you're playing music by a composer from the past, you can get that feeling.
Like you're there again, right? You're going right to the source. If you're reading their notes that they wrote, you're mm-hmm. going to the source of where that came from, right? You're right. Sharing from, dipping into the same pool, right?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing to be a part of like an orchestra and playing something like a Shostakovich symphony or, you know, Mozart or Beethoven. But then again, there's the other part is the natural part of it is playing an acoustic instrument and saying, this was a tree once and now it's this.
Yeah.
And that's reverberating something. It was a living thing, a living
right
tree, and now it's... Now it's an instrument.
Yes. You know. Kim Kashkashian, when you saw her perform live at UB, was that the only time you've seen her perform live?
Yeah, and I'd heard about her. There are a few friends of mine that had played some recordings of hers, and I thought that was pretty neat. you know. And I just wanted to bring her up because it's interesting to see have an artist that's a woman and a violist, and an unusual combination of playing classical and contemporary.
And contemporary. She's like considered a bit of a trailblazer, right? Because she does that. She plays the contemporary music, and as she says, it's like sort of, she feels like it's her duty to, you know, you can't disregard composers from now just because the people from the past are so they're in the pantheon of like the composers, right?
Right. And I think the stuff that when you get into the more modern stuff, it's very intense, especially if the composer's alive. Like she was saying, she was working on a piece by, I don't remember which composer had written for her, but she said they spent 8 hours on one line of music.
What?
And to try to understand where the person is coming from.
Say that again.
Well, she said that she had worked on with this composer, this piece, one line. It was like 8 hours they were together working on it.
Wow.
But to have that become, it almost becomes like this philosophical exploration. And to also be able to technically do what they want. Like, I've done some of that in the past where I've played stuff that I thought these composers must not have been a string. This composer might not have known as violin or viola, because I'm doing stuff that just doesn't feel right.
Doesn't make sense,
but that's part of this exploration into composing for instruments and creating something new sounds.
I think now it's raining here in beautiful Buffalo. It's a beautiful summer rain, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which is music in itself, right?
It is.
So, Mary, you're playing with 10,000 Maniacs. You're playing with John and Mary and the Valkyries. Sometimes we play shows together as Girls Gone Mild.
Mm-hmm.
People can find you, your music, online. They can download your music. They can watch your videos and your interviews, which is what I did. And I just want to encourage people to continue to support your career and your beautiful music.
Well, thank you so much. As I said, I have great respect and love for your music, and we always have such a great time when we get together.
We sure do, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
All right, will you come back again?
I will.
All right, and let's maybe we'll hashtag Kim Kashkashian. Mm-hmm. And let her know that we're talking about her today.
Yeah. That would be cool.
That would be great. All right, Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, it is true. That's Mary Ramsey playing the viola in the background. Thank you for listening to The Great Unsung. I learned a lot this week. I learned about Kim Kashkashian. I learned that Mary Ramsey was named for her grandmother, Steve. I learned that I still like doing this podcast. Please subscribe to our show. Please share it with your friends. Please listen to Mary Ramsey's music online and go see her in concert. Thank you for being a part of this. We'll see you in the next one.